asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances.
So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Hala talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
I'm Matt.
And today we're talking deadly debt, housing crash hopes, and the expensive American dream.
Given inflation, everything costs more than it used to, Joel, but the American dream...
Even your dreams.
It kind of feels like something that shouldn't cost more, but we will talk about that.
If I start actually getting charged for dreaming, I'm going to have to talk to somebody about that.
That's silly. This is our Friday flight, though. We're going to talk about the stories that, A, are either the most interesting stories to us, or B, the ones that also apply to your finances mm-hmm. the most, the ones that we think you need to be paying attention to. Did you want to talk about Shohei Ohtani?
Yeah.
And okay, you got a baseball note here.
We're not turning into a sports podcast, I promise. But the Shohei Ohtani contract, even if you don't care about baseball, I think
that's
this
how
is
you say
interesting.
Shohei?
That's what I'm going to
say. I don't watch baseball, so I just read it and I see Shohei.
Yeah. No, I think it's Shohei.
That makes sense. But Shohei Ohtani.
Japanese right. player, plays two ways, pitches and hits. I mean, he's a phenom. Nobody does that in baseball.
He's like a modern-day Babe Ruth,
pretty
basically.
Much. Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And so, and people specialize in baseball now. So this guy, because he does both, and he does them both incredibly well, it's just massively impressive. And he just got, Matt, the biggest contract in baseball history, $700 million.
I saw that.
But, and here's why we're talking about it, the way he constructed this contract is fascinating. He's only getting paid $2 million a year for the next 10 years.
Much less than that $700 million headline number.
Yeah, he's deferring a huge chunk of that. $68 million payments for basically the decade after that. So I thought this was just interesting from a couple of perspectives. One, the Dodgers are kind of participating in buy now, pay later. They're saying, like, we want the Ohtani now, but we'll pay the price down the road. And this is going to allow them to amass a better team, I think, be able to pay other players and bring in and have just – and they've already got an incredible team. But what are your thoughts on Shohei's kind of way of thinking about this, that he's saying, hey, listen – yeah, I want the big contract, but I don't mind getting paid down the road.
You don't have to pay me till later. Yeah, so, I mean, there is a lot of focus on the numbers, right? They're like, oh, well, he grew up in Japan, 0% inflation over there. So for him, the money 10, 20 years down the line, it's going to be worth to him the same amount.
Yeah.
But then you've got the future value of money coming into play. And it's just like, well, what if you had that money? You would be able to invest it.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, I don't think he really cares about the money, because I think I read somewhere he's making like $40 million a year in endorsement deals.
At least, yeah.
And so for him, it's like it doesn't really matter. And so what I truly think is that he's doing it for, speaking of baseball, for the love of the game.
Yeah.
Like he literally, the ability for the Dodgers to free up more of their payroll to bring in other players. Because like when you're at the top of the game like that, what you want to do is freaking win. And for him to be able to... Like, he's the one that suggested this contract to the Dodgers. This wasn't the first time he shopped this idea around. The Dodgers were the first one to take it. But this allows him to have a better chance at winning, and I think that's all that really matters to him. Money, He's fine with the money. He doesn't really care about the money. He just wants to stink and win.
Once you get to a certain point, do you really need more, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so I think for him, it's a massive win. I also think it's a win for the Dodgers as well, because like you mentioned, the buy now, pay later sort of standpoint. And I view it less through a consumption lens and more through an investment lens. And here... And I know you might push back on that a little bit because you're like, well, what is an investment or not?
Well, they've already sold a ton of jerseys. I'll say that.
So you've got that going on. But it makes me think about what's something that we finance today, a house, right? Like, and we use mortgages in order to do that. The Dodgers are essentially there haven't been a ton of deals to this magnitude that have taken place like this.
Yeah.
And so by the Dodgers doing this, they've kind of got that first mover's advantage. So it makes me think of, let's go back to housing. Imagine we lived in a world where everybody bought their homes paying cash, right? Prices of homes would be a lot less. Now, imagine you were the first person ever to get approved for a 30-year mortgage. You would have the pick of the litter. You would literally be able to any house you wanted.
Superpower.
And a much nicer house. And that's going to be true until everybody else also has 30-year mortgages as well, and then you revert back to some sort of normalcy.
Well, that's interesting.
So for the Dodgers, I think this is a killer smart move in a way for them to totally crush it over the next decade,
that,
I think.
Somebody asked me, hey, do you think that these kinds of contracts are going to become the norm moving forward? I think the answer is actually probably not. And why?
Well, it depends on the success.
Well, it depends on that, but it also depends on the player, because the player has to have enough financial acumen to realize and the ability to fund their lifestyle on a greatly diminished salary in the here and now.
And not all players are going to be superstars.
Exactly.
Like Shohei.
Well, and even that, like, it's a lot of people want their money. They want their money now, right? It's like that show me the money Jerry Maguire mentality. So
yeah, that's true.
Are there going to be enough players who have this kind of long-term perspective that Shohei's got? I don't know. But the contract's fascinating. It's going to be interesting to see how the Dodgers do. And they're going to be...
I don't see how they're not going to do great, because they really are going to be able to put together an incredible squad.
They're going to be the team
to
be reckoned
with. And I do think
more
teams will start to take sort of this approach to it, where they're saying, hey, we got to do this in order to compete, and all of a sudden becomes the new norm.
I will say, 10, 12, 15 years from now, though, when they're paying Shohei $68 million a year and they don't have him on the field and they've still got to field a team, it could get tough.
Could
tough times for the Dodgers then, yeah.
It's like, what's his name? Bobby.
Bobby Bonilla, yeah, it's like this, but on like to the
steroids.
80th degree, yes.
Mark McGwire levels.
So, all right, enough baseball talk. Just thought you guys might find that interesting. Let's move on to the Friday flight. Let's start off by talking about credit card debt for a second. There was a new poll. It found that credit cards are the biggest obstacle to building wealth. 39% of adults said that credit card debt is their biggest threat to building wealth, which, Matt, I think they're probably spot on. And actually, I'm surprised that the numbers are that low. What else is your biggest threat to building wealth besides your credit card debt? I don't know, maybe
yourself?
A lack of education? Yeah, your own
consumption, your own habits, perhaps?
That could be part of it. But recurring credit card debt, it really is one of the biggest hurdles to making progress with your finances. And something like 50% of Americans are not following the number one rule of plastic, which is paying the bill on time and in full. And so as a nation, we owe more than $1 trillion overall in credit card debt, which is a big, scary number. And we dug into the numbers recently, Matt, and it's not quite as bad as it seems, although it's still bad. The average balance is something like $6,000. And let's say you only pay the minimum amount each month at a 20% interest rate, which is, I would say, generous given this current environment. 22 is about the average.
Sure.
It would take you more than 17 years to pay off that debt, and it would cost you more than $9,000 in interest. And it's just hard to make progress if you've got that millstone around your neck. I get why people say that credit cards are such an obstacle for them.
Totally agree. Yeah, if you find yourself in credit card debt and you're listening to this, we're not trying to shame you necessarily, but we do want you to know, though, that this is a big deal. It's worse than basically every other kind of debt out there. Because, like, student loans have gotten a lot of attention recently, right? But at least in that case, you're getting a degree that will earn you more money, more income, more lifetime earnings. Or with mortgage debt, we're buying an appreciating asset that puts a roof over our head. It's, you know, what's the hierarchy of needs that, that we are required?
It's up there.
Shelter. It's important.
Maslow thinks that one's important. Yeah.
But credit cards can be a great tool if you're using them right, but we want you to experience compounding interest in the positive direction. We want you to be investing your money. We don't want you forking over thousands of dollars to the credit card companies where that interest is working against you. That's not the situation we want you to find yourself in.
So if you are in credit card debt, we recommend the tool undebt.it, undebt.it. Check out that website. We'll link to it in the show notes as well. But come up with a plan to get rid of that debt because, credit card debt hanging over your head is a problem. It's going to prevent you from being able to achieve the financial goals that you've set out for yourself. It's time to get rid of it and get rid of it quickly.
Yep.
All right, Matt, while we're talking about polls, another one came out at the end of last week, and it found that young folks want the housing market to crash real bad. 53% of Gen Zers and 46% of millennials, so basically 50% of people 42 and younger or whatever, want the market to tank. That's according to a LendingTree poll. Even many current homeowners want to see declines in prices. So it's not just people who are like, I don't own a home yet, I really want one, and dang it, if the housing market would just crash 30%, I could afford to buy one. Even people who already own a home kind of want the housing market to take a dip. And it's because they said they want their property tax bill to go down, which I can understand. Like if prices go down, property taxes go down. And a lot of people were shocked last year when property tax notices were sent out. But are we going to see price declines? Are these hopes likely to become a reality? It's hard to forecast the housing market. We talked about that with Lance Lambert this week. But I would say increasingly the answer is looking like no, I don't. We've kind of said that the whole time, that we don't think that there's some sort of massive correction in store. Minor corrections maybe, but massive ones probably not.
Yeah, and I think you've got to be careful what you wish for as well. Like for all the aspiring homeowners out there, and you're thinking, oh, if only the housing market would crash, then I could afford a home. Okay, let's roll back the clock a little bit.
15 years.
Let's get back in the Wayback Machine and look back to the Great Recession.
Story time with Matt.
When we saw a housing bubble pop, when we saw housing affordability drop, well, what happened? Like the world, our country was in a massive amount of hurt.
Dire straits.
And what also happened to a lot of jobs during that period of time, they were eliminated. Mm-hmm. Millions of people lost their jobs, which that actually makes it less feasible to purchase a home. So all of a sudden, not only can you not buy that nice little bungalow or that ranch that you've been eyeing, you don't even have a job anymore. Yeah. And so to think
job is a crucial part of being able to afford the home.
It's so important. And the housing market is such a big industry that, man, to actually hope that the housing market crashes feels a bit myopic, a little short-sighted.
Well, and when the banks
in my opinion,
took ownership of homes back in 2008, 2009, like, they couldn't give them away almost. Like, think about housing prices cratered, but it was also, there weren't many buyers out there either. So you're right. The housing market crash often comes with other side effects that you don't want.
Yeah, and for those who are current homeowners too, and you're upset about the fact that you're seeing your property bill on the rise, well, you're either the one who purchased that home and caused that price to be to be what it is. But let's just assume you've been there for 10, 20 years. You can always appeal your tax bill. And that's something that we've talked about on the show before as well. That's a legitimate way for you to try to get your tax bill down.
Yeah, and you can DIY that thing. Don't have to pay anybody a dime. And you can potentially save thousands. You can hire somebody. I've hired somebody in the past, a couple $100, and it saved me thousands. So just because battling City Hall is not fun also. But and the truth is, I don't know that record levels of unaffordability can last forever. But the only thing that you and I can control are our actions and our savings rate. And so holding off and renting, given the current market conditions, that continues to make sense for a whole lot of folks, Matt. I mean, I get the desire to become a homeowner, but sometimes it's best just to kind of hold back and wait and keep preparing so that you're even more prepared once the opportunity comes along instead of trying to force it.
That's right. Okay, so at least one of the things that is possibly contributing to higher home prices, albeit in a very small way across most of the country, is Wall Street ownership of single family homes. You often see that in headlines. It's never fun to start bidding against, let's say, a hedge fund who's got vastly deeper pockets. There are at least a couple members of Congress who are trying to do something about that. There's a bill that's been introduced to force these hedge funds to liquidate all of their properties over the next decade and then to never actually be able to buy single family homes in the future. These investors cumulatively own more than 500,000 homes across the U.S., which I will say on its face, it sounds like a lot of homes or single family homes until you take into account the fact that there's 82 million single family homes out there. So that's actually, it's less than 1%. It's truly just a drop in the bucket. And so it's hard for me to not be cynical when I see legislation like this being floated around that it just seems like virtue signaling. It looks like a way to get in front of your electorate and say, I'm fighting for the little man.
Yeah.
I'm trying to stick it to the big banks, to the big hedge funds, when in reality, A, they know it's not going to pass. But B, even if it were to pass, I think it would have a pretty small impact on the actual affordability of homes.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I also don't think it would have zero effect, right? So I kind of feel two ways about this. I tend to agree with you, at least to a certain degree. But I also think that the Wall Street's encroachment into single-family homes has harmed first-time home buyers, especially because they're buying up some of the cheapest housing stock in the country, in various cities around the country. And in particular, like we talked about with Lance this week, Atlanta is like
sure.
a city
but
where they
have
specialized.
The exception, though. I mean, across the country, it really is such a small portion. And I also can't get past the idea of like, we're encouraging folks to do something similar as mom and pop investors. Like we're materially not all that different than the institutional investors.
I don't know that I agree with that. We could talk about that in more in depth, I guess. But I think there's a difference between hedge funds coming in and because there's a need for rental real estate. But when hedge funds come in and buy up by the thousands we're kind of creating a nation of renter sort of scenario instead of just kind of providing rental housing stock that's necessary for people who aren't ready to buy a home yet or are in a city for a limited period of time. But I guess that we're also making something out to be like one of the biggest problems that's not actually the biggest problem, right? So Wall Street buying homes or, you know, Airbnb short-term rentals, like in the case of New York City where they just put the kibosh on that. Those have often been made out to be the scapegoat. And this is why housing prices are so high. It's Airbnb and it's Wall Street coming in. And in my opinion, it's local housing laws, it's regulation, it's zoning ordinances that make it onerous to build that are really creating the biggest problem.
Completely agree.
That's
with
the
that.
Real tragedy here, right? And we're not addressing the biggest thing, the elephant in the room. And so, case in point, there was this Wall Street Journal article this week, Matt, about why it took 17 years to build a 49-unit building in Los Angeles. So the hoops the builders have to jump through in order to get something built. A lot of the NIMBYism, where people don't want anything built near them. There was like one whole county in Los Angeles at one point that tried to make the whole county a wildlife refuge or something like that to prevent any sort of building. It's that kind of stuff. That has a massive impact on our ability to create new supply. And guess what? No new supply means higher prices, right? Limited supply, higher demand means prices are going to go up. And so that is the biggest problem. Maybe this would help a little bit, this law right now, but it's not going to have nearly as big of an impact as the things that can be done locally to kind of reduce the red tape and add density to a lot of the most popular urban areas.
I think Kate is actually in the process of getting our yard registered as a pollinator, National Audubon pollinator site.
There you go.
As well, that way nobody can build an apartment building in our front yard.
That's right. Well, it's pretty small front yard, so I don't think anyone's
planning on doing that anyway. Because she loves gardening.
But this one will be an interesting one to follow, this bill, see if it goes anywhere. My guess is it won't, but I'll be watching. And on the note of local laws, by the way, Matt, New York might do something that the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, has been trying but unable to do, and that is ban non-competes. They would join, I think, like four other states in doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And this bill in New York might come with like a salary cap, right? So non-competes would be allowed for jobs that pay less than $250,000, but not for kind of the highfalutin folks. And I think you and I probably still disagree on this one. Yeah, you're not a fan of non-competes.
I take the libertarian approach.
Yeah. So I am a fan of non-competes, at least. With the salary cap, I think actually makes sense to me because, those folks who get paid big bucks, they can often look after themselves. They can refuse to sign it and just be like, no way. If you want to hire me, I'm not signing the non-compete. Or they can deal with the consequences of signing it because guess what? They're making enough money. They have enough wherewithal to figure it out. But in my estimation, the biggest problem with non-competes is that like in the fast food or service industry, right? Like non-competes end up taking advantage of folks at that end of the wage spectrum. They end up depressing wages, increasing prices, and they kind of prohibit economic growth. So I'm with New York on this.
If you could like wave a magic wand and say, hey, let's have non-competes not be a thing, and with there being no other consequences of those actions, I'm all for that. But how it is that we arrive to that point, it matters a ton. And I would be all about folks having the freedom to be able to go and work for a different employer. But how we get there and government action and legislation and bureaucracy, in my opinion, isn't the answer. Like even the article you mentioned, the apartment building out in LA, I feel like that's a perfect example of government involvement and the hoops that you have to actually jump through and how that actually stymies growth.
Removing a hoop though.
No, but even still, like it's a rule. It's something that is put in place that in this case, employers have to abide by. And people especially profit-seeking companies, employers, they respond to incentives. And a big, like, that's why we're seeing, I mean, there are so many companies that are moving to states that have less restraints when it comes to how it is that they're able to run their companies. So you see all these companies moving to Texas, to Florida, to Tennessee, and away from states, unfortunately, like California, who have imposed a ton of laws, whether it's in the form of housing or, again, even in the case of non-competes. California is one of the states that has that in place. And so, again, it's not that I disagree that non-competes kind of suck. It's just that how we arrive there and how it, in my opinion, should be left more up to the individual.
Yeah. So I guess that being the case, depending on where you live, non-competes might be well and good and completely lawful. So for you as an individual, you have to think long and hard.
You got to know what's up.
About whether or not you want to sign that non-compete. And
absolutely.
But I think I've read too many stories about people making Subway sandwiches or working kind of like a minimum wage security job, and then it turns out they've signed something that kind of unwittingly that doesn't allow them to do work in that same similar work in that same vicinity. And yeah, that's just tough to stomach.
It's a tough consequence. But I mean, but the unintended consequences, I think, are what we have to watch out for. Anytime there's any sort of like wide scale general policy that gets placed, there are consequences of those actions that policymakers don't take into account.
And oftentimes they're hard to see.
Yes,
hard to foresee what
absolutely.
They're
going to
be.
And that's not to say they're guaranteed, but man, they oftentimes happen more than we think. And it does prevent, for instance, something like housing for that market to open up and for the ability for folks to have access to affordable housing.
Yeah. All right. We've got more to get to on this one, Matt, besides just debating the merits of non-competes. So
more stories.
Yeah. We'll get to more, including we'll talk about stock market predictions. They're kind of scattershot going into next year. What are our thoughts? We'll give them right after this. Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So, if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org. I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach. Every single summer, we've already got that trip to St. Simons on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host, or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. Spring cleaning is kind of an annual rite of passage. We've all got to do it, minimize the junk that we have in our house. Emily and I, we just cleaned our closets out. It took hours, but it was so worth it. Now we've only got stuff in there that we love, and it's easier to find everything too. And so, you know, while cleaning your closets is helpful, well, there's something else you can do for your family this spring. Shopping for life insurance with Policy Genius, for example, is a really important part of your financial planning for the year.
That's right. Yeah. And here is the thing that's important to remember, because you might be thinking you don't need to check out Policy Genius because you've got a policy through work. But even if you have a life insurance policy through your job, it may not offer you enough protection for your family's needs, and it may not follow you if you leave your job. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Policy Genius works for you, not the insurance companies, and that means they don't have an incentive to recommend one insurer over another, so you can trust their guidance.
Save time and money and provide your family with a financial safety net using Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com.
right, we're back from the break, and it's now time for Joel to give his prediction as to what the stock market is going to do next year.
I just shrug my shoulders. That's my prediction.
That's my emoji. The yellow guy with the blue shirt, both arms up.
That's right.
But the actual year-end wraps, like, those are fun. But when it comes to the actual 2024 predictions, those are less fun. And
it makes me think of Spotify Wrapped. That's fun.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you're trying to predict what I'm going to listen to next year, leave me alone.
But a Business Insider article titled, "Prepare for the S&P 500 to plunge 24% by mid-2024 and the U.S. economy to sink into a recession," J.P. Morgan's top chart guru says. Which, of course, he does.
I wonder if he signed a non-compete.
Man, we're basically in, like, the stupid stock market prediction season here at the end of the year, especially, too, after we've seen surprising gains this year.
Yeah, literally, as this episode airs, we might be getting close to all-time highs, again, in the stock market.
Yeah, the Dow hit all-time highs a couple days ago, and possibly the S&P. And some folks might be thinking, well, I'm not a guru. Like, I don't keep up with what the market's doing. Maybe we should be deferring to the expert here. Well, except if we actually look back to the end of last year, most of the predictions were completely wrong by a significant amount. We were coming off of a down year, and most of these quote-unquote experts, they predicted more doldrums for the market. They were expecting a recession, and that did not turn out to be the case at all.
Or at least if they were like, oh yeah, no, the stock market's going to go up, they're like very, very ginger, tepid predictions, right? Nobody was like, nobody was out there saying, I'm pretty sure the market's going to go up by 24% this year.
They weren't being, they weren't bold about it, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. nobody was saying that.
It's the psychological loss aversion, which is, like, that's the term that describes the fact that, like, for instance, if we experience a 20% decline, that's going to feel much, much more painful for whatever reason than a 20% increase.
Yeah.
And so anytime folks are making these dour predictions, they always seem wise and prudent, as opposed to somebody who's more of an optimist.
Yeah.
And by definition, I guess we are, because we tend to base our, well, I'm hesitant to say predictions, but what we think the market's going to do just based on history.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's not based on, like,
it's more likely to go up.
Something that we pulled out of our butt or anything
like
that, right? So from where we're standing, we'd say that predictions are a lot like opinions, right? Everyone's got one, but most of them have really no pertinence on your life whatsoever, especially when they're just making headlines around the internet. And it's not that we don't think that the market's going to have a tough year next year. The market's crushed it this year.
It could have a tough year.
It could certainly, take a swoon. We don't know. Or it's not that we're sensing a boom either. Like, it's really that we don't know. And honestly, we really don't care. We're investing for the long term. So these predictions that come out every December, they feel completely unnecessary.
They're a distraction from what we truly need to be doing with our money, which is spending less of it and investing more of it.
Right. And I feel like we don't necessarily have to talk about this, but we just know that a lot of folks out there are swayed by at least some of these predictions. Like,
exactly.
The headlines come out and they're like, they see dollar signs in their own eyeballs. And of course, they want to take advantage of or avoid a potential bust. But I would say this one stat worth sharing. It comes from our friend of the show, Ben Carlson. He ran the numbers and he found that the stock market was up 22 out of the 34 years following a 20% gain in the market. And the average size of the gain the year after we saw that massive stock market rally was 8.9%. So two out of 3 years,
data,
the market's going to go up again.
66% chance of you being right.
That's right. So I'm just going to, go with history, go with the numbers, not sort of go with the predictions that people are making. Our suggestion is to look at history, tune the plethora of predictions out, and keep doing what you're doing, stashing away money for your future.
I guess another way to look at it is that J.P. Morgan chart guru has a 33% chance of actually being correct.
That's true.
So,
but even then, maybe we get like a 4% decline and he still looks like an idiot.
Exactly. All right, man, let's talk about the American dream, because listener Gary, he sent us something from Investopedia about the cost of the American dream. And apparently it's going to cost you $3.4 million now over your lifetime.
Oh, that white picket fence has gotten expensive, huh?
It has, yeah. So this term was actually Investopedia's number one search for term of the year. We've got a couple thoughts from the numbers that they pulled together. First of all, it is a lot more expensive to live in America these days. We're not going to deny that.
It's not sugarcoat it.
Especially for the bigger ticket items like cars, like homes. But on the other hand, some of the items listed, you don't necessarily need to spend nearly as much on in order to live a happy life. They had listed things like weddings and cars, pets. Well, they're all based on averages, but you don't have to be average. It makes me think of the standard American diet which I always laugh at because the acronym is SAD. You don't have to be an average American. You don't have to lead that kind of life. We're all about being maybe a little better than average here, and especially when it comes to our money. And the average needed to retire that they calculated was $750,000, $750,000. And the thing about that number is that it can seem so stinking overwhelming, right? Yeah. Like you're thinking, how am I supposed to get close to $1 million? But if you save diligently over the years, you can achieve a balance that's going to be that high or even higher without actually having to invest that much money. And that's because of compounding returns and the way that it works. When you invest that money, you don't have to come to the table with $750,000. You just have to start investing at an early age. Let that money do the work for you. It's not up to you necessarily to do that work.
It's not that there's like no basis of truth in kind of what Investopedia is spinning here. They gathered the data and they're not completely wrong, but I guess it just leads to a lot of pessimism when people are like, cool, 3.4 mil? Yeah, how am I ever going to do that? Well, this is across the entire course of your life, and we need to question the assumptions of how much some of these things cost, including, like you were just talking about, retirement. It's like, a nest egg of 750K in your tax advantage retirement accounts would be awesome. And I think for a lot of How to Money listeners, it's achievable. It's just that you don't have to fork over 750K all in one fell swoop. It's a function of time and growth in the market that your dollars are going to experience, right?
Yeah, going back to Shohei Ohtani.
Right.
Future value money right there, man. That's what it's all about.
We can learn a lot from that guy. And a recent Wall Street Journal poll found that the majority of young Americans think that the American dream is dead. People are pessimistic about our country in general and the economic opportunities that they have available to them here. And I'm not going to deny the challenges that we face. Our political climate, the polarization is depressing, right? Inequality is also a real problem. But Matt, it kind of makes me think about that recent combo we had with Dr. Gene Twenge about narrative versus reality, right? Millennials, as a cohort, are doing far better than predicted and even better than they feel. It's like the headlines don't quite match the facts on the ground.
Yes.
And so
it goes back. It's loss aversion again.
Yeah.
It's the fact that any small negative thing we experience is just magnified, not only by media, but also for whatever reason, just the way we think about
things.
Well,
and I think it's also comparison, right? And I think
sure.
the more that we're
there's
like,
a lot more of that today than there was in the past as well.
And it's you used to be able to just look at your neighbor. Now you can look at all sorts of people. I mean, I think we feel that maybe at times as podcasters, we're like, we're doing good. But man, we're no Joe Rogan, you know, and like there's times where I'm like, well, what if
Huberman's really blowing it up?
Right,
why can't we have growth like him?
We're not nearly as interesting or as long-winded as he is, I guess.
But you don't like listening to 3-hour long podcast episodes about how alcohol is bad for you?
It gets a little tedious.
Okay.
It gets a little tedious after a while. But I get why he's popular. I get why people like him. But I guess there's more opportunity for us to compare than ever before. But when you look at the data over the past few years, Americans are doing better financially and inequality has actually decreased along some metrics. So we definitely face headwinds, but we still live in a country, I would say, that offers more opportunity for advancement and wealth building than basically any other in existence. And I know, I'm basically like 100% optimist, but I hope I'm not being like unrealistic in my optimism here.
No, yeah, I think it how we interpret data and view things, it matters a ton. And what you said too about over the course of your entire lifetime is what these numbers are taking into account. And when you look at a massive number that big of like what life is going to cost, like we don't look at anything on that type of scale.
Yeah.
The context matters so much. Like it makes me think of when like it's fun with numbers, Joel. It's fun with statistics. It's something like the average human is going to sleep something like 25 years of their entire life.
Ridiculous.
And you hear that and you think, oh my gosh.
What am I, a vampire?
I don't have that much time on hand to sleep. Well, yeah, but that's because you're looking at it like all in one fell swoop, like in a single snapshot. But guess what? When it comes to the day-to-day, like A, you do need that much sleep, and B, it's actually a lot more doable than you think. and so the difference between sleep and money, however, though, is that sleep is something, for the most part, you can't really change. Like humans need just about the same amount of sleep. Everybody does. But when it comes to how much money we actually need to have on hand.
I found a new hack, Matt.
Shut up.
I'm going to share it with Andrew Huberman.
You listen to it on the Huberman show.
Uh-huh.
But when it comes to what it is that we consume, we do have control over those things. And just because, like you said, the whole world or your neighbors, your quote unquote neighbors on social media are living in a certain way, that doesn't mean that you have to live that way. It's actually something that we have more control over than something like something more biological like sleep.
And
the context matters so much.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that how do you define American dream? And I think some people define it as the nice house with the white picket fence, 2-car garage, 2.5 kids, and the ability to take two-week vacations a year or whatever. Like, how you define it really matters. And so I guess maybe the stock American lifestyle, that's not what you and I are after either. And that's not what we think our, you know, How to Money listeners need to be about, unless that's really what they want, right? But so rethinking,
yeah,
kind
you
of,
take way more vacations than
exactly,
just
exactly. Well,
a
I
week,
do.
We got it. Yeah,
I really do. Yeah. And so, yeah, rethinking kind of what you're aiming for matters in this too, I think. But the Wall Street Journal, they boiled the question down to, like, will hard work offer you the opportunity to get ahead? And even that, like, getting ahead is in the eye of the beholder. And so much of it comes to, getting ahead is a warped term, because it makes people think of, well, am I going to do better than my peers? Am I going to do better than the folks around me? Am I going to supersede them? And so, yeah, even the way the question's worded, it comes with a lot of, like, perception, right? Yep. And so I really do think that hard work and smart work in this country for a whole lot of people will pay dividends, right? And that there's a lot more in your control than you think. It doesn't mean there aren't things out of your control, and it doesn't mean that there aren't headwinds. But I do think that the pessimism in and of itself actually breeds inferior results. We've talked about that before on the yep. show too, Matt, how optimism is such an important part of, you know, building that financial future you want.
It's true. All right. So a way that you can get ahead is through entrepreneurship, man, working for yourself. A recent poll found that 1 in 3 Gen Zers, they want to do that. They want to be their own boss. And the reason for that is because they think it's the best way to build wealth. And I don't think they're wrong. We've seen a ton of small business formation, like the numbers of, I think, new business applications skyrocket since COVID. And that's good for our country. And it's also great for many of those individual business owners. Certainly not going to be for everyone out there. What you do for work, your personality, that matters a whole lot. There are a lot of folks listening and they're, you know, you're like, guess what? No, guys, I'm just always going to be.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to own, I don't want to have the responsibility, because there is a lot of additional responsibility when you own your own business. There's nothing wrong with traditional employment, but I think for a good swath of people, starting a side hustle, ramping it up so that you can eventually leave your main gig, I think that can be a great way to work towards being your own boss, getting ahead, fulfilling the American dream, and investing in yourself. And, you know, at least considering what it might look like to do your own thing is something that we would recommend. And it's also something that you can do on the cheap. It does not have to be something that you have to take out a small business loan for. You don't have to hit up all of your relatives at Christmas and say, hey, I need y'all to bankroll me. This is something you can ramp up slowly on the side.
And it's certainly not possible to avoid debt completely for every business you want to start.
Totally.
But I think you think outside the box. You know, go back and listen to, and we'll link to this in the show notes, our episode that we did with Alan Donegan. And he was talking about, even with, like, physical products and stuff like that, how you can get proof of concept, how you can start the business without taking on any debt. Matt, I'm thinking of a friend right now who wants to start a dessert business. And he could go out there and he could, like, rent one of those ghost kitchen sort of things.
What
and
kind of dessert?
Start slinging dessert. Banana pudding is what he's best at.
I know you're talking about.
Yeah.
And it is good banana pudding.
It's really good.
I will say it's maybe the best I've ever had.
It's delicious. And so I think he's going to do well if he goes down this path. But it's also, there's a way to start smaller, get the proof out there, start making money, actually, before you go hook, line, and sinker and start taking on debt to kind of get the ball rolling, right?
Totally.
But yeah, no, I love this mindset of wanting to work for yourself. I think that small business mindset, that appreciation of what small businesses can provide, that's one of the greatest things about this country.
Heck yeah.
All right. Well, Matt, that's going to do it for this episode. We hope.
That's all.
Hope our listeners out there get 8 hours of sleep, plenty of water. Now you don't have to listen to Andrew Huberman because you just heard me say it.
It's true. And you just saved yourself 3 hours.
That's right.
All right. We hope everyone has a fantastic weekend. And we'll see you back here on Monday. So until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.
Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're really choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers.
Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies.
Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.